Support for the Exchange podcast comes from you, our listeners, and from McLean Middleton, New Hampshire's largest law firm. For over 100 years, they've been committed to their clients, community, and colleagues. Locations in Manchester, Portsmouth, and Concord, New Hampshire, and Woburn and Boston, Massachusetts. Learn more at McLean.com.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. Just by the numbers, 2019 was a great year for New Hampshire's economy, with a growing labor force, rock-bottom unemployment, and continued low poverty rates. But these positive trends have created other economic stressors, a housing and labor shortage, two factors that could start to tug on the state's economic growth this year. Meanwhile, nationally, it's an open question how foreign policy turmoil and a presidential election will affect the economy overall, both nationally and here in New Hampshire. And so today in The Exchange, it's our New Hampshire Economic News Roundup, a look back at the top state economic stories of 2019 and predictions for 2020. And what's your economic forecast, either for your own situation or for the state overall? Let us know. Our email, exchange@nhpr.org. Once again, exchange@nhpr.org. Comment on Facebook, tweet us, or call in 1-800-892-6477. And our full panel of New Hampshire economists is back. Brian Gottlob, Russ Thibault, Jeff Feingold, welcome to all of you. Happy New Year, and thank you for being here.
Hey, great to,
be here, Laura.
So I want to start with you, Russ, and before we look back at New Hampshire's economy and get your predictions, which I'm really looking forward to, a broad question. What's the economic impact, Russ, of the U.S. killing of Iran's top general last week? This has been all over the news. NPR has been looking at the political and national security impacts, so we'll set that aside for now. But how does this affect business and economic policy, Russ?
Well, probably the only soft spot in the economy right now, when you look at all the indicators that are out there, is business confidence. And I think that international conflict is probably a prime generator of weaker business confidence when it's already weak. So my feeling is that the main thing that it does is add another element of uncertainty into the business picture, particularly for the business side of the equation, and probably also for consumers too. But right now, consumers are so optimistic that there's some wiggle room there. But on the other hand, business confidence is actually pretty low right now, and this is kind of a hit on that.
Well, and if you're a business, you need to make plans, you know, a year, two, three, 5 years out, and businesses hate uncertainty. That's what I've heard from them. They just want to know what the deal is and make a plan.
Exactly. You know, give me the rules, and I'll play the game and try to win. But if the rules are changing, as seems to be the case right now with the Middle East, then I think it does add another element of uncertainty.
What do you think, Brian?
I agree 100% with Russ. The uncertainty is the real issue. I think we're in a really unusual place with the economy right now. It's fundamentally strong, but despite that fundamental strength, it just feels increasingly fragile. So it's a very odd combination of strength and fundamentals, but yet a lot of uncertainty and a lot of fragility. Even before this occurred, I was looking out at 2020 and thinking, my God, there's just an awful lot of issues that were not clear, that are uncertain, that could really have a substantial impact on the economy. And then this happened, and this kind of jumped to the top of the list. So I think Russ is absolutely right. The uncertainty is really mounting for businesses, and business confidence is weak, and it's been declining for a while.
Go ahead, Jeff.
It's something else that is, we can see right now, immediate effects of it. Just in the last few days, the price of gasoline has gone up. You just go to your local gas station, you see it's gone up 5, 6, 7 cents a gallon, even more in some places. And that's really because we're dealing with the Middle East.
And that's critical because consumer confidence, as
Russ
said, has been strong. But one of the biggest impacts on consumer confidence is the effect of gasoline prices.
And that's the thing, is that that's really, as has been pointed out many times in the last year on this show, consumers' confidence is really what's, the consumers are what's driving this economy, the U.S. economy. And if that starts teetering, then, you know, all
when
bets
people
are
feel
off.
Insecure, they don't.
And if you look, it's just a little bit after nine. But you know, the stock market's going to open lower to, you know, the U.S. stock market and world markets are already down because this is really the first market day since the assassination. And we don't really know what's going on in that part of the world, but it's not good right now.
Russ?
You know, it's kind of overall, this thing has been the economy that keeps on giving and giving and giving. Now, this past year, we made it the longest recovery in history.
Yeah, decades since right. the recession officially
ended. Stock market is phenomenal, up 30% this year. I mean, the American economy hasn't expanded 30%. That's a sign of this consumer confidence, investor confidence, not business confidence, investor confidence. And it's really phenomenal. So, I mean, to have a 30% jump this year when the beginning of the year, I remember on the panel last year at the beginning of the year, I was nervous. I was nervous about the economy and about, but we've added 2 or 3 million jobs nationally. We've had great job growth in New Hampshire. I think that's because of Brian moving over into the state government. But we've had great job growth right across the board, low unemployment, low inflation, low interest rates. It's still, you know, fundamentally, we're this backdrop of Iran and Iraq and the Middle East is, fortunately at least, it's coming on top of a pretty good economy right now. And as Brian said, there's a lot of uncertainty. It can't last forever. Sometimes I sit back and wonder, when is this going to end? You know, we're looking for the weak spot. But right now, things are still pretty sweet.
I want to remind everybody that it is our first New Hampshire Economic News Roundup of 2020, and we're going to spend part of the hour looking back at some of the biggest state economic headlines from last year, and then we'll get our guests' forecasts for 2020, and we want to hear from you. What's your own economic prediction for the new year, either for your own situation, your own workplace, or just for the state overall? We'd love to hear from you. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Again, exchange@nhpr.org. You can comment on Facebook. You can tweet us. Once again, that email, exchange@nhpr.org. Our guests are Brian Gottlob, principal of Polycon Research, an economic research firm based in Dover, and director of the New Hampshire Economic and Labor Market Information Bureau. Russ Thibault, president of Applied Economic Research. That's an economic and real estate consulting firm in Laconia. And Jeff Feingold, editor of the New Hampshire Business Review. So let's spend a few minutes, gentlemen, looking back at 2019, and then we can move forward to 2020. And Brian, to you first, please, what was the economic story or trend that you did not expect to see in 2019? What surprised you?
I think the lack of wage and price pressures was, for me, probably the biggest surprise. I think a lot of us were expecting that wage pressures would increase with the declining unemployment rate and that interest rates would likely rise. None of that really happened, although we're seeing a little bit higher wage increases.
Yeah, wages have definitely gone up.
And the other thing I think, and Russ alluded to this, is kind of the disconnect between what's happening in financial markets and the real economy. The real economy has been solid, but it's not been anywhere near as solid as the stock market would indicate. Profits haven't been rising at a rate of 30% year over year. And so I think we're seeing this increasing disconnect, and that does make me nervous because I think a substantial sell-off in the stock market would have significant impacts on confidence in the economy.
Well, you're an economist, so you're paid to be a little nervous.
Always
and,
nervous.
You know,
always
glass
looking
half
out
empty.
For the next shoe to drop.
So you thought you'd see more inflationary pressures, Brian, given that wages are going up.
Who would have thought a year ago and predicted that the Federal Reserve was going to lower interest rates? To me, that was kind of a shock. And again, it's that almost inconsistency I see in the economy between we hear we've got a wonderful economy, it's strong, we're adding all these jobs, and at the same time, the Federal Reserve is nervous enough about prospects and uncertainties that it decides it needs to cut rates a couple of times. That's kind of a disconnect for me, and this we're in a really unusual time period.
Jeff, how about you? What stories did you cover this year that you didn't expect?
Well, actually, just overall, I remember sitting here about a year ago, and we were talking about 2019, and I think it's safe to say we all didn't think that the economy was going to be as strong as it is.
Because it's a long recovery.
It's been a long recovery, and, you know, there were signs back at the end of 2018 that, you know, things looked like they might be slowing down. We looked at all the tariffs that were going to have a big effect and other forces that were not working in the favor of U.S. economy and certainly New Hampshire economy. We're talking about, we'll hit on the labor shortage, which is the major thing. It's amazing that the strength of the U.S. economy and the New Hampshire economy just continuing through all of 2019 without any signs of any wavering well, there's some signs of wavering, but it's still been very strong. And I'm just completely amazed by it because it still seems to be in New Hampshire in particular. It's amazing what's the construction that's going on, the expansion in many of the sectors that's still going on, despite what we're talking about, these uncertainties and all these other things that are out there, but it's still just plowing right through.
Yeah, so you thought in 2019 that we would be talking today, our first economic news roundup of the year, about a softened economy in 2019, but that did not happen.
I have to admit, I mean, I'm not going to blame it on these guys, but people like, you know, that I talk to, like economists, they give you all the confidence.
Stand in line.
Right. So how about you, Russ? What did you think we'd be talking about today in terms of 2019 that didn't happen or surprised you?
Yeah, I don't know if I have a lot more to add to what Brian and Jeff have said. I mean, I thought the economy would soften this year. We started out with really a lot of uncertainty. GDP growth in the first quarter, in fact, was very low, but it really picked up steam. Now, overall, things have slowed a bit, but the thing that I think right now is that expectations are very high among consumers. It's sort of like Christmas. You think you're going to get everything you want, but maybe you won't. And when you don't, how are you going to react? And I think that the expectations are very high. I think almost the average layperson feels, for example, the stock market's going to continue to grow, unemployment's going to continue to stay low, inflation's going to continue to stay low. And I said before, and I say again, looking forward a little bit, I know we're talking about going backwards, but there aren't many tools left in the arsenal to address any softness. So if we're expecting a huge Christmas and it doesn't come, we don't have much in the way of correction measures
those
in terms of interest
levers.
Rates or federal spending. But that's looking a little forward. But that was the case last year as well. So what happened, as Brian pointed out, the Fed did lower rates 3 times, and maybe that's why we're still in pretty good shape.
That's a lot for 1 year, isn't it?
It is, yeah. At the start of the year, there was maybe a thought that actually they'd be raising rates. So major policy shift at the Fed, as Brian pointed out, is probably, if you're getting into the weeds of the economy at all, that's probably the thing that's really least expected, 3 rate cuts this year.
Yeah, I was reading an interesting article over the weekend about Ben Bernanke, though he was the Fed chairman in the days of the Great Recession before he was two Fed chairs ago. And he spoke at an event where he was very concerned about not having the interest rate weapon really. It's not, he said it's not going to be enough to, if there's any kind of major economic downturn. And he's talking about fiscal issues, fiscal stimulus and all that stuff that would take political. It wouldn't be the Fed's ability to do it. It would be in the political arena. And then he was concerned about that because he doesn't know if, considering what's going on in Washington today over, you know, just anything political, it's going to be contentious no matter what. And he was concerned about that.
If Congress and the president will have the stomach to deal with debt and
deficits. To actually come to some kind of consensus on what can be done.
Mm, Brian, go ahead.
Yeah, I think that last year at this time, I was thinking that the effects of the tax cuts would begin to wear off fairly substantially by the end of 2019, and the economy would be slowing. And the economy has slowed. The thing that I didn't really anticipate, and I don't think anybody did, we talk about fiscal stimulus. Well, we've had a pretty significant fiscal stimulus. It's continued. So while the tax cut impacts have sort of diminished and subsided, we've had a deficit-fueled fiscal stimulus. You know, we're at over $1 trillion deficit. That has had a significant impact on the economy. So nobody, you know, we talk about the lack of policy options, and I thought we all were saying, well, we can't lower interest rates anymore, and the government won't have any money to spend, so we can't do a fiscal stimulus. Well, we've done a fiscal stimulus, and it's added significantly to GDP growth in this last year, and probably will continue to provide support into 2020. I don't see any effort right now to rein in the deficit fueled stimulus that we're
so stimulus it means you could sounds good right that's a, right, a pleasant right. sounding word, but it has created a $1 trillion deficit. I remember the days when debt used to be measured in the trillions, not deficit, but now we have a $1 trillion
deficit. It's just really unusual. Again, there's just so many paradoxes in this economy where we've got a stimulus at a time when the economy has been strong. We typically have fiscal policy that is countercyclical. That is, we spend more when the economy is weaker in order to provide a stimulus, and we tend to save more when the economy is strong. We've done it just the opposite.
But just because of that huge deficit, that's the kind of thing we're talking about in terms of the stomach, having the stomach, if we need to be really spending money to lower taxes more or to just spend more money on infrastructure, whatever, you know, big jobs programs, housing. That's what we're talking about. Are they going to have the stomach to say, okay, let's go for a $2 trillion deficit?
They don't seem to be holding back to this point.
We should probably do a whole program about debt, deficits, what it all means, and where we're at. But just to wrap up this loop, go ahead, Russ.
I was going to say two things. One thing was that if you go back to the last recession, 2007, 2008, Ben Bernanke's tenure, the Fed fund rate was 5%. So they had a lot of room to lower rates and stimulate the economy. When it's 1.75%, you don't have much room. So that sort of is a perspective on the thing we haven't talked about too much, although Brian alluded to it, is the kind of convoluted income growth that we've had during the last year, during the last 10 years. And if you look at some of the estimates, the top 20% of the economy is going to have income growth of around 13%, three or four times higher rate of increase in income for the top 20% than the bottom 20% is the projection. It's like 13% versus 4%. So one of the things about this economy that's disappointing is that this economy that keeps on giving, it keeps on giving mostly to those that have.
You know, that's interesting, and that's a headline I saw a lot when I was researching for today's show, is that one possible cloud on our economy is this income inequality that you talk about. Russ, how does that sort of bring everything down?
Well, if you have
that gap is
wide.
Yeah,
you know, if you're in the lowest quintile, every dollar that comes into the household is going to be spent. It's going to be spent on rent, utilities, health care, clothing, whatever. If you're in the top 20%, you're not going to – so income that – accrues to the bottom 20% is more likely to go back into the economy and stimulate growth. Income that goes to the top 20% is less likely to do that.
I see. Go ahead, Jeff.
I think a perfect example of that is the tax cut that Brian was talking about. You know, really, it's been documented that many of the biggest corporations in the United States, if not all of them, have not really invested that tax savings in expansion, in raising wages necessarily, in hiring more people and building new plants. What they're doing is they're buying back their stock and setting their stock prices up, which is one of the reasons the stock market's been doing so great. And that's so it's not like they're putting it into the general economy. They're just putting it they're putting it into the economy, not the way the tax cut was designed to do.
Maybe one reason they're not expanding is they can't find enough workers. That's a big topic that we all talked about in 2019. The labor shortage
that is not necessarily true of all of the industries we're talking about. And there really has been just attempt to just eat the money up, just keep digesting it into their system and just not putting it into the general economy.
All right. Coming up, we will get your predictions. Ready, gentlemen, for 2020 on all these aspects of New Hampshire's economy. We'll definitely touch the labor shortage, some struggles of manufacturing. We'll look at the healthcare industry, and also trade was a big economic topic in 2019, and I know it will be in 2020 as well. And we'll start taking your emails, so send them in, exchange@nhpr.org. What's your economic forecast for the new year? Once again, exchange@nhpr.org. You can use Facebook, Twitter, or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477.
Support for the Exchange podcast from NHPR comes from UR subscribers and from
Edvest in You, a local New Hampshire nonprofit providing college student loans and student refinancing options. information online at nhstudentloans.org or by calling 1-855-887-5430.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today, it's the New Year's edition of our regular New Hampshire Economic News Roundup, and we're looking back at some of the top economic headlines of 2019 and getting a forecast for the state's economy in the new year. Let's hear from you. What economic trends do you think were most important or affected your life the most last year? And what are your predictions for the new year? Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Once again, exchange@nhpr.org. Tweet us, comment on Facebook. Brian Gottlob is here, principal of Polycon Research and director of the New Hampshire Economic and Labor Market Information Bureau. Russ Thibault, president of Applied Economic Research in Laconia. And Jeff Feingold, editor of the New Hampshire Business Review. And gentlemen, I want to open this segment with an email from Catherine, who says, I'd just like to chime in and state that the stock market is not an accurate reflection of everyday workers in the U.S. who are not invested in any way because we do not make enough money to invest, nor do we have 401ks. Catherine says, I myself have a master's degree and work in mental health, where, as you know, the pay is low. We are not compensated for our time and stress, not to mention the vicarious trauma we suffer. I have been a single mom since my boys were 4, and they are going to be 30 soon. They are both disabled and are my sole responsibility. Catherine says, I am $25,000 in debt at zero interest, which I hope to pay off in time. Bottom line, she says, I think if you ask the average Joe on the street, especially given recent international events, we are screwed for 2020. I don't have any hope for this year. Thanks, she says, and I hope it's a better year than I expected to be. Catherine, so much to unpack from that email. Thank you very much. I think we covered already, gentlemen, in our first segment, just, you know, people's concerns about the impact on the economy and their lives to the events that we've seen unfolding just since the weekend. But I think to you first, Jeff, you know, she says, hey, I have a master's degree. I work in mental health. The pay is low. So don't tell me the stock market's doing great, therefore I'm doing great.
No, she's absolutely right. I mean, this is what we're talking about when Russ raises the issue of income inequality and how the economy is really benefiting people who are wealthier than people who, you know, the rest of us, you know, in the bottom or, in the middle and bottom. It's just that it's not having the same effect. So when you talk about a 30% increase in the Standard & Poor's Index, that means nothing to almost anybody. I mean, people have 401ks. Unfortunately, she doesn't have that, but a lot of employees do have that. A lot of people have, IRAs and things like that, and that's benefits from those kind of things. But when you're talking about people like Catherine, it shows how vulnerable a lot of people workers, people working in the economy, are to just various vagaries, and it's a concern that I don't think is necessarily being understood by a lot of people. And you know, there's some of the Democratic candidates are talking about it a little bit, but for the most part, it's just kind of in the ether there.
Well, Catherine, I really appreciate the email, and I hope that 2020 is better for you. And I'm especially glad she wrote because she's working in mental health, a field that has severe workforce shortages. And we talked about this a lot this year, gentlemen, on this economic roundup with the three of you. We also did a whole series in May on the labor shortage. And Brian, you helped us kick off that series. So what are your forecasts for the labor shortage here in New Hampshire for this year? Does it continue? Does it get easier? What happens?
It's going to continue, and it's going to be probably a decades-long issue for the state. It's going to be an issue for most states.
Decades, plural.
Yeah, and it's largely because we're confronted with long-term demographic issues that are working to constrain the size and growth of our labor force. We've had low birth rates for decades in this state, which means, those people won't be aging into the workforce. We've got increasingly large numbers of retirements from our workforce. And the implications of that are that even if we don't see job growth like we've seen in the past few years, we're still going to see a lot of openings. And we see that in many industries. We see that in manufacturing, where there hasn't been great job growth, but yet there are a tremendous number of openings. Why? Because the labor force in that industry is largely an older workforce. Those people are retiring, and we don't have individuals to replace them. The other issue is we saw lower in migration into New Hampshire. That's picking up again. But in much of the first decade of the 2000s, we saw very low in-migration and out-migration, that is traditionally a way that we have grown our labor force. And that's slowed. It's picking up again. But all of that has contributed to, you know, a really substantial, along with job growth, really substantial constraint on our ability to add jobs.
Well, I want to ask all of you a couple more questions about this demographic issue, because it is so deeply tied to the economy. And since you mentioned, you know, birth rates versus death rates, Brian, new data from the Census Bureau late last year did show the number of deaths in New Hampshire exceeded the number of births for each of the last 3 years. I want to play a little bit from Ken Johnson, senior demographer at UNH's Carsey School. He says it's the first time this has happened.
Having more people die than be born in a state is very unusual. Until the last couple of years, only Maine and West Virginia had ever had more deaths than births.
Again, that's Ken Johnson, senior demographer at the Carsey School. And yet, gentlemen, Governor Sununu, in his end-of-the-year press release on the New Hampshire economy, says 2019 a banner year for the New Hampshire economy. He does say that the New Hampshire is the most popular place in the Northeast, I'm quoting here, for millennials to locate themselves. So sounds like, Brian, you know, there's two things going on.
Yeah, I mean, you know, we've faced long-term challenges in demographics. I've argued for the last couple of years that I think we're seeing some improvement. And Dr. Johnson is correct. But, you know, we've had more deaths than births in many of our counties, 6 of the 10 counties for some time. So it's not unusual everywhere in the aggregate. It is unusual, but there are many counties in New Hampshire where that's been the case. I do think, you know, we're seeing a pickup in migration among a younger demographic than we have in the past. And we were ranked 10th in terms of movement into the state among millennials, movement of millennials into our state, which is completely out of character for the Northeast and the Midwest.
That's another surprising economic story from 2019.
Absolutely.
We've been talking about the opposite trend, right, Brian, for the last couple of years.
Yeah, I mean, you know, New Hampshire has a reputation for losing all of its young people, which is true to a degree, and that's happened for decades. What we're seeing now is, in addition to the typical demographic that we attract, which is generally married couple families, ages 30 to 44, you know, we're starting to see that 25 to 29 year-old in migration. That's been happening for a few years. It's starting to pick up. And that's a really positive trend. And it's a reflection of some of the positive things that communities are doing.
Yeah, it's really happening at the community level.
Right.
Decisions
that
communities are making. Improving their downtowns, improving their housing situation,
right,
which we're going to focus on in our third segment, by the way. So
right.
Go ahead, Ross, and then Jeff. Yeah.
I was going to say that you're absolutely right that it ties into everything, the labor shortage. One of the things it ties into is wages. We do have 130,000 people a day commute to jobs, primarily in Massachusetts.
130,000, wow.
Every day. And that's out
like
of a labor force, Brian,
correct
if I'm wrong, maybe 700,000 more or less. So that's huge. That's like 15%, 1 out of 8 is that, 1 out of 7. Commute to Massachusetts every day. And if you drive 95 or Route 3 in the morning, you know it's true. So if wages were stronger in New Hampshire, were higher in New Hampshire, we would attract yet more migration that Brian's talking about, and we'd probably be able to recapture some of those people that are going to Massachusetts because wages are higher, job quality is better. So that's one thing that could make a difference, and that's just market forces that Brian pointed out, I think, in the very first thing he said today, that wage growth has been disappointing, and Catherine, the caller, is saying the same thing. So maybe one solution that would be very sweet would be to see stronger wage growth.
Although wages have gone up,
they've gone up by 3%. You know, stock market 30% this year, wages 3% this year. Who's winning? Who's losing?
Well, and from what I hear, the traffic down to Boston on 93 has just gotten worse and worse.
It seems
and worse
to be horrible.
And worse and worse.
Yeah. Wait till the expansion of 93 is completed in New Hampshire, and then it'll be even worse because there'll be more people going down that way. But
well, we don't know. Maybe
issue.
It'll help.
Maybe.
But we're talking economics
maybe.
Today.
If you build it, they will drive.
So what about demographics,
but
Jeff?
I was going to say this about the point about millennials coming in the United States and New Hampshire, because I remember when I wrote the article about it, when it first came out, it was really surprising, to say the least. But to add to what Brian's point was about having 6 of 10 counties with more births, more deaths than births, these millennials are going into only very specific parts of New Hampshire. It's not all of New Hampshire that's benefiting from this. It's Manchester, it's Seacoast, in some cases it's the Upper Valley, but for the most part it's the southern part of New Hampshire. It's not the bulk of the, geographically speaking, New Hampshire. Those areas of the state are still in a tremendous decline demographically. And that's something that we have to remember because, you know, New Hampshire's a small state, but we're still very, it's still very diverse socioeconomically. And, you know, we have to remember that because we can talk in general about the state, but when it comes to something like this, like in migration, it's really going to be the southern part of the state that's benefits.
A couple emails coming in, gentlemen, and I want to remind everybody, you can send us an email with your own questions about the economy in 2019, and we'd love your own predictions for 2020, either at your own workplace or your own personal situation or just for the state overall. What's your prediction for the New Hampshire economy in 2020? Again, our phone number, 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Once again, exchange@nhpr.org. Chris in Manchester writes about what we were just talking about. Please comment on the impact of the near completion of the widening of Route 93 between Salem and Manchester on the development and economy of southern New Hampshire and the state at large going forward. I think, he says, it's a real game changer, especially considering our proximity to the hot Boston market. Chris, we were just talking about this, so it's great that you chimed in. And Russ, what do you think?
Well, I think that there has always been a very intimate connection between the metropolitan Boston economy and the southern New Hampshire economy. I think that in the last maybe 5-7 years, because of the construction on 93, that has weakened a little bit, even though, you know, commuting patterns are still extremely strong. Once that gate is fully open and the cattle is free to roam the ranch, I think we're going to see two things. I think we're going to see yet more out-migration to those good jobs in Middlesex County in Massachusetts.
Because it's easier to get there?
It'll be easier to get there. And then more, I don't know if you call it, maybe pressure on the housing market within the I-93 corridor, again, because it's easier. And home prices are significantly lower. Now, not that long ago, I was on a panel with one of the state's larger developers, and he said, look, if I build homes in Massachusetts, I can sell them in a heartbeat. If I build them in New Hampshire, it's much more difficult to sell them. And that's
really,
yeah, that's
the
really
housing shortage, which we're going to talk about in a few minutes.
Yeah, it's kind of convoluted. It used to be the other way around. Easy to sell in New Hampshire because prices, and I think part of the reason for that is the congestion that we've spoken about. And so the improvements on 93 during the construction phase, of course, it's awful. Remember the big dig and its impact on Logan. But once the construction is finished and traffic is freer to roam, I think we're going to see more migration to jobs in Massachusetts and more pressure on the New Hampshire housing market within the corridor.
Wow. Well, very interesting. Thank you for the email. And Arnie in Canterbury writes, how is the tight labor market affecting wages at the low end of the wage scale? For example, fast food, housekeepers, and health aides. And Arnie, thank you so much. It's a great question. Brian?
Yeah, actually, at the low end, wages have increased as much as at the high end. And I did this analysis not that long ago where I took 15 or 20 of our lower wage occupations in retail and fast food, those types of occupations, as well as 15 to 20 in the higher end, and compared wage growth over the last 3 years. And essentially, no difference. And if anything, in some of them, particularly in the fast food industries, wage growth was actually a little bit higher than in some of the higher wage occupations. So the pressures have been there. The problem that you have is that despite that increase, it's still, the wages may have gone up 6% or 8% on an annual basis. 6% was not unusual. It's still a lower wage. So while the increases have been there, those wages are still substantially lower. But there has been strong increase in lower end wages.
Russ?
The thing is, 6% when you're making $8 an hour is not much money.
Right.
That's,
to get an apartment or
It's just, yeah, I mean, 6% if you're making, you know, $50 an hour, that's a big deal.
Great.
6% if you're making $8 an hour, you know, you're barely going to cover the gas price increase that Jeff spoke of earlier. So I think the percentages are nice, and I totally agree with what Brian's saying. But the impact of it, it's easy to overstate it.
Yeah. Also, in terms of that income growth in retail and some hospitality as well, we aren't really seeing that as much in areas like, let's say, in the mental health workforce, which is desperately needed right now, because a lot of those organizations are nonprofit, and they're only able to pay what, you know, the money they take in, and we've seen really not exactly the most beneficial or generous Medicaid reimbursement in this state. It was one of the lowest, if not the lowest, in the country at some point. And, you know, that workforce, which is desperately needed, is not getting seeing those kinds of increases in their wages. And that's why I believe, as Catherine was in that workforce.
Who emailed us earlier.
Yeah, and you know, that's why there's a lot of stagnation there. And that what happens is, in a workforce that's, I mean, you could argue, you know, we need them in retail and fast food and all that, but this is a workforce that is desperately needed in New Hampshire in particular, and we're not able to attract more people into it because the wages are lower than working at McDonald's.
Wow. So to that effect, we have an email from Melody, who also works in the healthcare field. She says, from my perspective as a nurse serving the boomers primarily, I see staff suffering from low wages, high cost of housing and utilities, poor health care, insurance choices with high deductibles, and a high cost of education, higher education that is prohibitive at best. Melody says, we are looking at a future with a growing elder population that has contributed to the fiscal pool their entire lives and are staring down a future of poverty, uncertainty, and betrayal of the public trust. Melody says, we need to invest in housing to serve both young families and elders, single-payer health care, and a return to integrity and stewardship in our faltering culture. And Melody says, rising wages, P.S., for whom? We also have an email from David in Amherst, who's also concerned about income inequality. He says it increasingly deprives our shared services, like public education, infrastructure, of the very funds they need to function. He says income inequality will continue to create insidious, profound weaknesses, which will increasingly undermine the general economy. And by the way, our producer, Christina Phillips, is working on a show about income equality, inequality, you know, sort of where that stands, crunching the numbers, what we see here in New Hampshire, and the bigger forces at work there. So thank you to both those people who emailed in. Russ, go ahead.
I have one that I want to share. My wife's a teacher in the middle school in Laconia. And she works with students with special needs. And there's one of them that's doing exceptionally well and made the honor roll and got a bumper sticker saying, my kid made the honor roll at Laconia Middle School. And the girl went to my wife and said, but we don't have a car to put the bumper sticker on.
Oh, dear.
Mm. Yeah, you know. So I think that really hit me, I got to say. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, congrats to your wife, by the way. Go ahead, Brian.
Yeah. You know, I think the issue of inequality is a critical one. I do want to just say that I think there's a couple of perspectives on it. One has to do with a belief that somehow our economy is fundamentally unfair, and that's an issue of unfairness. I see it a little differently. I see an economy and a labor market that's increasingly being polarized between those individuals who have education and skills in demand, those who don't, and the gap is widening as artificial intelligence, automation is pushing more people from the middle down to lower wage jobs, and that's increasing the inequality. That's a different issue than a fundamental unfairness. It has to do with what we do for training, education, and expectations of individuals. But we have an economy that's increasingly rewarding skills, and that's the driver of this inequality.
All right, coming up, we're going to turn the corner and talk about another huge, huge economic story from 2019 and how you guys see it playing out in 2020. That is real estate, commercial, yes, and tourism-based real estate, yes, but affordable housing for sure, because that was a big, big dominant story in 2019. More on that coming up. Stay with us.
Franklin Savings Bank has been a supporter of New Hampshire Public Radio for many, many years.
Don Beers is head of marketing for Franklin Savings Bank and a proud NHPR underwriter.
For us, it was important to attract those who choose to live, work, and play in the communities that we serve.
Learn more about how to connect with NHPR's community-minded audience at nhpr.org/underwrite.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Tomorrow on our show, what does it mean to be resilient? And why are some people more resilient than others? That's tomorrow on The Exchange. Send us an email before the show to exchange@nhpr.org. and then join us live at 9. This hour, it's the New Year's edition of our New Hampshire Economic News Roundup, and we're going to focus especially on housing this segment, a topic that dominated economic discussions last year, along with New Hampshire's labor shortage, which we've already talked about. We'd love your comments and questions now about housing, its impact on your life, its broader impact on the New Hampshire economy. You can send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Once again, exchange@nhpr.org. You can use Facebook or you can tweet us. And gentlemen, housing is something we talked about almost every single time we got together last year on our economic news roundups. We also did entire shows on this topic. Jeff, can you just paint the big picture for us from housing in 2019 and what people are saying about 2020?
Well, the housing in 2019 was continued a pretty bleak picture where we just have this great demand for affordable housing, housing that can be paid for by people who have jobs in the sectors we were talking about, and there's just a dearth of those. And from what it sounds like, from numbers I've heard, from Brian and Russ, and most recently Russ, that what we really need is about 15,000 to 20,000 housing units built a year. And we're getting
a year?
Total. We have a deficit now. Yeah. Of 15 to 20 is.
Yeah, yeah. That's okay. I misspoke. We need 15,000 to 20,000 units, and we're building 3,500 a year, which is, means many years out before we even come to meeting that demand, but there'll be a continued demand for housing. And what that means is that we've been seeing rents go up. We've seen housing prices the median price for a home now is over $300,000 in the state as a whole. In different parts of the state, it's different. But for the state as a whole, it's over $300,000 for a house. Basic single family house, nothing particularly fancy, and that's a trend that we've seen go on for years since the end of the recession, and it's just been getting worse and worse for people who want to live in the state, who are trying to find a place, who want to take a job in the state, but it's just not as affordable as it had been. Back in let's say the 90s, maybe when New Hampshire benefited from having much lower housing prices than Massachusetts, it's not necessarily the same anymore. And that's not, it just makes it harder for people to come move here and live and work here.
So what's going to happen this year, Russ?
Well, I think that what's happened that sets the tone for this year coming is there's always a linkage between housing, then the labor force, then the economy. That's always there. But this year, I think this past year, it rose to prominence. And we have had some state policy changes that are, I think, the most dramatic we've seen since, I've been doing this for 40 years or so.
Remind us what those are. Yeah, that's really interesting. The governor has a new housing task force.
A new housing task force came out. And among the changes are a housing court. If a local community is denying building permits that that it should be granting, there's now a housing court that's being set up.
Housing Appeals Board, I think, is the official name.
Thank you, Jeff. Yeah, that's one. About $5 million out of the real estate transfer tax revenues going into an affordable housing fund. So there's a multiplicity of policies at the state level. It's really become more prominent and sort of the lightning rod of maybe, I don't know if it's fair to say economic policy, but if you combine housing and labor force, that's number one in the state. And that hasn't always been the case.
Well, those are the two big issues, again.
Yeah, it is an extreme problem for particularly young households with $300,000 home prices and $1,300 two-bedroom monthly rents on average, half being more than that.
So you talked about this new court or panel, whatever it's called, that will hear disputes if towns, as you said, Russ, aren't approving the permits they should be granting. But that's subjective, right? I mean, some towns are saying, no, that's a very,
that's right.
That's an important wetland, and we want our water quality to stay high quality.
So if you wanted to build affordable housing in a community that said, no, we don't want it, until this housing review board, you'd have to go into the superior court system. And that takes a year or two. It's not a high priority case compared to, say, violent crime or some of the drug stuff. So you're going to have to wait your turn to get into court. Lawyers are going to pile up. This is going to be a more efficient way to get a fair ruling.
So it's not necessarily a green light to every
developer out
there.
No, it's not a green light. It's just a ruling beyond the local planning board that is more accessible. And it should, if it does its job right, should actually be fair to the communities and fair to the development community.
Are you on that task force, Brian?
I am not.
Full disclosure. Okay.
No, I'm not. Just a couple of thoughts. Talk about 15 to 20,000 shortage in housing. All of that is at the lower end. All of that's at the lower end of the market.
No shortage of big, expensive
right,
homes.
Right, exactly. And communities deserve a lot of heat for what's happening. But I also want to say that, you know, the economics are more difficult now than they were 10 years ago. Construction costs are significantly higher for developers. And it just makes it more difficult for developers to make the economics of affordable housing work. So it takes a special effort, not just allowing anybody to come in to get more affordable housing. A set of unique circumstances, I think, will have to develop for the production of more affordable housing.
So land prices are higher.
Yep.
Wood, I hear,
yep,
is a lot higher.
They're down a little bit from a little over a year ago when there was more trade frictions with Canada, where we get a lot of lumber from. But they're still much higher than they were during or before the Great Recession.
And cement is higher, too.
Cement is higher. All kinds of...
You don't think about that.
Yeah, no. All kinds of materials.
Steel is also...
Go ahead, Jeff.
The other thing that I just wanted to say is that one of these costs that has been that developers have been and builders have been complaining about is the cost of going through this court of the court system that adds time, could add years to the development of a project. So by having this housing appeal boards, it streamlines that process and potentially can lower those costs, which was, I think, the basic concern in terms of setting up that housing appeals board. The other thing I just wanted to say about this affordable housing task force and the recommendations is they're bipartisan, because I think it's for the first time in a while that members of both parties understand that how essential this issue is to the economy, that this is important. I don't want to say the economy, to the people of New Hampshire, to the citizens of New Hampshire, it's extremely important. And I think that they're finally realizing how difficult this has been and what the state can do, at least in some small ways, to help make the process a little easier.
Again, we want your economic forecast for 2020. You can give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. And in this last segment of the show, we're focusing on what was a huge economic headline from 2019, getting predictions for 2020, and that is housing. So again, we'd love your stories, questions, comments. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org, or call 1-800-892-6477. Benno in Hudson wrote us, guys. He says, without a doubt, the lack of affordable housing in New Hampshire, our low wages make us an impractical place to live. Benno says New Hampshire could attract more people to the state and substantially solve our commuter traffic problem if we had public railways from Manchester or Concord down to Boston. And we did talk about that a little bit earlier. And I would love to spend more time, not right now, because we're talking about housing, looking at the impacts of that widening of I-93, of potential railway. So thank you very much, Benno, for the note about housing. Michael also wrote us. He says, what conclusions about housing can be drawn by the fact that 15% of our labor force commutes? That speaks to the overall affordability of living in New Hampshire. Michael, thank you very much. And go ahead, Russ.
Yeah, I was going to say that when you think about rail right now, communities are getting ready for rail. Nashua has two spots identified for a train stations, and there's already residential development occurring around those spots, high-density rental housing that would accommodate and is anticipatory of rail coming eventually. Manchester, my firm is working with the Southern New Hampshire Planning Commission on the area between Granite Street and Queen City Avenue. Where the baseball stadium is, that whole area, that's being looked at as a train station.
That's interesting because the bus station in that area has been sort of decimated. Yes. They don't really have almost no surface there.
Right,
now.
Yeah. But
I was waiting for a bus once. I had to wait outside because it was locked, even though it was, the middle of the day.
We're kind of getting ready for it in a very preliminary way, maybe 10 years off. And the impact
10 years, that's
of
a
it,
long time.
That's a long wait outside.
But look at 93. Exactly. They've been working on that for at least 10 years. So these things do take a lot of time. And it's not even a commitment yet that it's going to be done. So the city of Nashua has stepped up to the plate and said, yeah, we'll help subsidize the service. So it would be a earth-shaking thing.
Okay. Well, thank you for those emails. This is great. I love hearing people's predictions for the new year and thoughts about housing. And we will do more entire shows, obviously, on housing as the new year unfolds. Let's take a call, gentlemen. Martha's joining us from Portsmouth. Hi, Martha. You're on the air. Welcome.
Hi. Good morning, Laura. Thanks for the conversation. I wanted to weigh in and just talk about how the lack of affordable housing is affecting families and individuals in the state of New Hampshire who are experiencing homelessness. I'm the director of Crossroads House in Portsmouth, and what we're seeing is that there's a tremendous demand for emergency shelter beds, and people's normal reaction is that we need more emergency shelter beds, and I just wanted to add to the conversation and say that it really is the need for more affordable housing, because once people are in our shelter, what we're seeing is their length of stay, one of our measurements, is increasing.
Because they don't have some place to go. Yeah, go ahead, sorry.
They don't have somewhere to go. So if people can exit an emergency shelter faster, the bed opens up for someone else in need. So that's just one of the many effects of the lack of affordable housing in the state.
Wow. Well, thank you so much for calling, Martha. We're going to have to dig into this a lot in the new year because there's so many repercussions, as Martha points out. But quick comment from you, Jeff?
I think one of the drivers of the homelessness crisis in New Hampshire is the opioid crisis. That's been really serious. However, affordable housing and the economy at the lower end is really what's driving it, helping to drive it as well, because there are entire families who just don't have a place to live, because they can't afford what we're talking about, $1,300 a month rents. And maybe the rents are cheaper up in the North Country, but there's no work up there. So, you know, this is the decision that has to be made by many families, many individuals in the state. It's separated from the opioid crisis. This is a much, or from mental health issues. It's a basic economic need, economic necessity, because there is no place to live. And that's, as Martha's saying, she deals with it on the front lines, and this is she's noticed it, and you could see it in other cities as well.
Wow, go ahead, Russ.
I just was going to say, looking forward, you've asked about, you know, going forward. I think the sort of, if you ask the question, what did 1980, 1990, 2000, 2010 have in common? They all were the beginning of a recession, and they were all the beginning of a decade. And here we sit in 2020.
Oh, Russ, stop. I was in a good mood when I woke up this morning.
I know. But then again, right now what we have is an election year. So the beginning of a decade is usually a pretty weak economy for some weirdo reason that nobody really knows. And an election year is usually a pretty good economy because, particularly a midterm election, everybody wants the economy strong, and they'll do everything they can to make it look good.
You mean particularly a presidential election, because that's what
we're
in this
exactly.
year.
Presidential year. You're going to do everything you can to maintain a good economy. On the other hand, we're in the beginning of a decade, and that always seems to end up being a soft year. So.
Okay, let's not invite him next time. I'm just kidding.
Okay, yeah.
Russell Dunn.
It's the dismal science, Laura. I'm just doing my job.
That's numerology. True. Russell's numerology.
That's right. That's true. They do call economics the dismal science. I did have one or two more questions about, again, real estate. We talked a lot about housing because that was the big economic headline, along with labor shortages in New Hampshire last year. But, gentlemen, I have noticed a fair bit of commercial construction going on. And, Russell, I'll turn to you first, but want to hear from everybody. Why does commercial construction seem to be a different story? Hotels being built, offices being built. Am I wrong there?
No, you're right. But what it is it's sort of more visible because it's concentrated into larger projects or certain communities. Manchester, Tuscan Village in Salem. Woodmont Common in Londonderry. So the projects are bigger. Main Street Market at Main in Bedford, they're bigger. Instead of having like a little development over here, a little development over there that you probably wouldn't notice, now we're getting these large projects that are concentrating the supply of new commercial activity into certain spots.
Do you want to jump in on
part
that, Brian?
Of it.
Yeah, I think Russ is absolutely right. When I look at the numbers in terms of construction contracts, they're really not exceptional, and they've actually been trending a little bit downward.
I see. So, it's just because we noticed
Yeah,
them.
They're really visible, and they're not only are they visible to the eye, they tend to be very high profile. You know, we read a lot about them in the newspapers or hear stories about them. Some of them are controversial in Bedford, you know, the change in plan. So I think they're just much more high profile. On balance, I think residential development, even though we're not building as much, has held up and has been as big a player in construction.
Go ahead, Jeff.
One other area where there's been an increase in construction commercially is in the healthcare sector. In particular, we're talking about big projects. Dartmouth-Hitchcock is in the pipeline right now. It's like a $130 million project to expand that huge campus, even make it even bigger.
Wow.
It's like 200,000 more square feet or even more, I think.
Well, we're an aging state, yeah. And as you get older, you need more health care.
And another place where another project that is just unveiled, that's been unveiled recently, is Catholic Medical Center is doing another major expansion. They just got a $15 million gift towards it just the other day. And Dartmouth also has, a $50 million expansion of its campus in Manchester underway. So this is it reflects what's going on in the economy. There's a need for their services, and this is what's happening.
Fewer new schools, more new hospitals.
It's
all back to demographics.
That's right. Okay, yeah. So that's your sort of short and sweet prediction for 2020?
For 2020, yeah, I think it's sort of like I was driving down, drove past Lake Winnesquam this morning. The ice is forming, but it's very thin, and you wouldn't want to walk on it. So I think it's a year to be cautious. At some point, this thing will end. We know that.
You mean the recovery?
The recovery will end. And so is it this year? I'd just be cautious this year. I think the probability of things heading south is higher than it was even last year at this time.
You want to make a very quick economic prediction for New Hampshire? Yeah. Numbers that you're going to be watching, trends you're going to be keeping an eye on?
I think it'll be a decent year. We'll have slowing job growth, but it will continue to grow. It will grow more slowly as the year progresses. That said, there's just tremendous number of uncertainties in the national economy that could affect us.
Yeah, that we talked about at the beginning of the show. Go ahead, Jeff.
Yeah,
I
agree with what both of Brian and Russ are saying. I think it's going to be there was going to be a slowness. I don't know if we're going to be able to notice how slow it's going until we look back on it. But I think it looks like there are various things going on, especially in the most recent days, how with the price of oil, you don't know what that can do to the economy. You know what it can do to the economy. It's not couldn't be good if it goes up as much as it could.
Well, we'll talk again in about a month. I really appreciate you all coming in today. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Laura.
Thanks, Laura.
This is The Exchange on New Hampshire Public Radio.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. Hey, if you like what you heard, spread the word. Please give us a review on iTunes to help other listeners find us. And thanks.